Hey there, Sports History fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
Our popular Football by Numbers series on Pigskin Dispatch continues as we go to jersey number 87 in the best players in NFL history to wear that number as Jeremy McFarland of the Football Family podcast joins us, and we have Jeremy's words coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of Pigskin Dispatch, and welcome to another edition of the Football by Numbers. And tonight's jersey number is the jersey number 87. And boy, we have some great people to talk about, some great players in NFL history for the last 101 plus years of NFL. And I have our good friend, Jeremy McFarland from the Football's Family podcast on Sports History Network to help us out here because it's such a big number. Jeremy McFarland, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey, Darren, thank you for letting me back on here. You know, I see you've cleaned up the place nice and neat. I like it.
Yeah, we got all the bales of hay and all the corn cobs in a row here. So we knew you were coming. So we wanted to make sure we tied it up here for you.
Growing up here in Tennessee, my granddad had some pigs. And I tell you what, they don't keep a clean place. So you do a great job with yours.
Okay. Jeremy, I wanted to just touch base with you because we haven't got the chance to, the great pleasure of talking to you in a while. How are things going over on the Football's Family podcast? And what have you had out come out lately?
Well, I am humbled and just in awe of the fact that I've had 50 episodes so far, 50, and it's
congratulations.
Thank you. It's gone by really quickly, and I've enjoyed every bit of it. The last one we had was we talked about the 1947 Steelers. It's a guy that you need to get on your show. You would enjoy it. And then the week before that, or the time before that, we talked about the flood that hit us just a couple, 3 weeks ago here in Waverly. And you know, we're looking at having some in the next little bit, having somebody come on and talk about fantasy football. So we've got some things coming up in the pipeline.
Yeah, I listened to that 1947 Steelers episode you had on about a week ago. Yeah, that was pretty good. That guy was real entertaining. I never would have thought of anybody writing about the 1947 Steelers, but he really made a really compelling case for them, and pretty interesting.
Well, I'm getting the book hopefully in the next few days, so I'll let you know what I think about it. But, you know, I'll give it to the Steelers. It's okay to read a book about the Steelers. It is.
You know, this is like my dream come true because you had that episode, 1947 Steelers on. Arnie Chapman, a football history dude, he just had the Mike Webster story play on this past week here as we're recording, you know, and he actually said the Pittsburgh Steelers are one of the greatest football teams of all time. I'm recording that, and I think that's going to be my new ringtone for Arnie Chapman now.
Did he have to kind of swallow that down a little bit when he said it?
I think he sounded pretty gleeful about it. So I'm taking that. I think he's a fan.
Well, I'll tell you what, when you look at the grand scheme of things in the NFL, you cannot say the 70s. You cannot speak about the 70s or really the 2000s without the Steelers. So at least you got that, you know, I said it. It came out.
I know. I got to live high on the hog while the water's low here because, you know, I know bad times probably got to hit one of these years, and I'm hoping maybe I can outlast it here. But we've been very blessed and fortunate as Steelers fans. That's for sure. We're spoiled.
Ever since 1969, you really haven't had that many bad times. You know, you hadn't had that. You've had, you know, three great coaches And I think Mike Tomlin will be in the Hall of Fame myself. I think he will be. You've had pretty solid quarterbacks, a running game that has been very impressive, and a defense that I don't know if it's the steel curtain from the 70s, but it's pretty close. So, you're spoiled rotten is what it is. That's what I have to say about the Pittsburgh Steelers thing.
I stand convicted of that. You're right. I and all other Steelers fans in my lifetime are very spoiled.
And there's nothing wrong with that. We have people here who lost their air conditioner, and I said, you know what? I like air conditioning, and I'm spoiled rotten. I don't know if I'd live back before air conditioning. I am spoiled rotten with air conditioning and indoor plumbing.
That's for sure. I mean, I can remember those days when I was a kid. We didn't have air conditioning and one television in a house. And probably a good segue into some of these players we're going to be talking about, because a lot of them we're going to be talking about are from that era of the 1970s.
Yeah, and one in particular, we'll get to him in a minute. I remember, and there goes my son's dog. But I remember watching some of the film and seeing a defensive player with an 87, and I thought that's kind of funny.
Yeah, we have a real good one to talk about tonight. I think maybe two of them to talk about. Definitely one that had 87.
I'm going to let you talk, and I'm going to let him out of his cage here, so he won't be. If you've got a husky, you understand when I say that he is howling. They're not just barking, they're howling. I'll be right back. Go ahead, Darren, and talk amongst yourself.
We have a good start off where we always start off of, and that is the Pro Football Hall of Fame and who they say wore the number 87. And the Pro Football Hall of Fame, they give us Willie Davis and Dave Casper, two great names in NFL history. You can't deny these guys of being in the Hall of Fame. And we probably have two or three more that will probably be in the Hall of Fame before too long. I'm saying maybe three that we'll probably see in our lifetime be in the Hall of Fame. But so far, just two players, Willie Davis and Dave Casper, in the Hall of Fame.
Dave Casper, I just love – now many people probably listen to this. They don't understand how great of a player Casper was. And the one thing about him that I really enjoy is when you look at his stats, he doesn't jump out as a – you can't compare him to Gronkowski or Gonzalez. You can't do that. You have to keep in mind when he played. But he was Kenny Stabler's most reliable pass catcher next to Biletnikoff. And the one thing I remember, the Ghost of the Post, of course, everybody knows about the Ghost of the Post. But when you look at the Raiders in the 70s, Casper is head and shoulders. He has to be up there in the top five of all times. Raiders players from the 70s.
Oh, I definitely agree with you. Not only the Ghost to the Post play, but he also was part of the Holy Roller play. Even his good parts, this great.
Now that Holy Roller play hurts my head even thinking about it now. How in the world did they not see that Kenny Stabler purposely pushed that ball forward?
It wasn't a rule that you couldn't do it in particular. I mean, it was like very on the outskirts of being, shady.
Well, what did Al Davis say? Rule number one, cheat. Rule number two, look at rule number one.
I don't know if he quite said that, but they definitely pushed the line quite a bit.
They did.
Raiders did. And that was part of their mystique and still their mystique. They loved wearing black and, just like the old cowboy movies, the good guys wear white, the bad guys wear black, and they personified that. They loved to have that personification, and they came to play, they hit hard, and they had some tough players like Dave Casper to do it. Now, I think when you're saying he doesn't compare, Dave Casper doesn't compare to Gronkowski and Gonzalez and Antonio Gates, but I mean the hardware and the way he was celebrating the NFL. I mean, he is up there. He went five Pro Bowls.
I'm saying that if you were to look at the stats, okay. See, I have right here. Let me see if I can pull it up here. Rob Gronkowski's stats just for right now. Gronk has, as of right now, he's played 10 seasons. Of course, many of his seasons have been cut short because of how he plays. He has been targeted, according to ESPN.com, 872 times, 566 receptions for 8,484 yards and 86 touchdowns. Now, that's insane. Now, you might see something different, but that's what I have right now. And then you have to also consider playing in the playoffs. Now, if you were to look at Casper's, let me pull up Casper's stats. you can't just look at him and say, well, him and Gronk are not in the same boat. Casper had, according to Pro Football Reference, in 147 games, he has 378 receptions for 5,216 yards. Now, you think, well, is Gronk that much better? No. The passing game, as everybody knows, you know, the passing game has changed over the years where the running back is devalued. The passing game is better because of the five-yard rule, plus a lot easier, a lot more lax on the calls and things like that. And the quarterbacks have gotten better.
Most definitely. I mean, you have, but the passing game in the modern era is done. It's made so there's more plays per game. So the offenses has more opportunities, which the NFL loves because it's, offense is everything. That sells tickets and puts people's butts in their TV chairs watching the screen. But, you know, what I'm saying is Dave Casper compares and for his era, if you look at it, Gronkowski has 5 Pro Bowls and 4 All Pros. So is Dave Casper. I mean, I know Gronk could still get more, but they're very comparable in the way that they were recognized by the league for
that. Absolutely, they are. But when people say, well, you look at the catches, you can't compare the catches, you can't compare the yards, you can't compare the touchdowns. Each one of them in their time were amazing or are amazing. And who knows, in 20 years, Gronk's numbers might be eclipsed by somebody. You don't know. I mean, it's just insane to look at how, you know, Kenny Stabler was not your prototypical quarterback. He's not a Tom Brady, but for what he did in his time, you know, he won. And I would say the same thing for somebody like Dave Casper, who many people probably don't know who he is, but they really should, because you can't really talk about the history of the 70s, especially without saying Dave Casper.
Most definitely. He and the Raiders were such a force for so many years, you know, that whole decade of the 70s and late 60s, even when they were in the AFL, and the early 80s. I mean, it just carried on. They were, when you're talking about dynasties, they were just in it every single year.
Oh, absolutely.
Fighting tooth and nail, you know, and many of them against my Steelers, you know.
And I'll tell you this, the Steelers, if there is not another reason why people out there dislike the Steelers, your Cowboys fans and your Raiders fans from the 70s know that they would have had more Super Bowls if it wasn't for the Steelers. Just keep that in mind, Cowboy and Raiders fans. It's because of Darren Steelers that you don't have as many Super Bowls. just saying.
I take pride in that, though.
That's, I know you do.
I just, that doesn't hurt my feelings at all to hear you say that.
It's like, yeah, what's your point, you know? But I'll tell you what, Dave Casper, and the reason why he's called Ghost of the Post, if you don't know, it's Casper the Friendly Ghost. Dave Casper is one of those guys I think needs to have more attention. But I've got another guy that I want to bring up, and if I can do that right now.
Sure.
And I got him right here. I had to go up to my office to get him. And I'm holding in my hand a Kevin Dyson bobblehead. And I have right here, Aaron, a book that I had to dig to find. It's the Tennessee Titans, Tennessee team, the pictorial history, the Titans. Kevin Dyson is the man who ran back the Music City Miracle.
That's right, yeah.
He is also the man who caught Steve McNair's last pass in the Super Bowl and was 1 yard short. And when I looked up Kevin Dyson's stats, his stats are not going to blow you away. They will say that he is the same height as Mike Jones, who tackled him. And I thought, well, that's actually kind of funny that they would mention that. But and I'm going to make sure you can hear me right here. Kevin Dyson, most of the Titans running a team back when he was playing had nothing to do with the pass. It was Eddie George. But Kevin Dyson had a year where in 1999, he had 54 receptions for 658 yards and 4 touchdowns. Overall, he had, according to Pro Football Reference, it's 2,300 yards and 18 touchdowns. Not necessarily what you would call jaw-dropping, but for me, Kevin Dyson will always have that place that I remember what he did for us.
I can definitely tell everybody in your world down there has got real excited since I talked about it. I'm hearing, you know, all kinds of growling and cheering from the Titans fans down there going on. So
things are
going on and really strong in support of Kevin Dyson.
Yeah. They are very excited about Kevin Dyson for some reason.
I think once you got that bobblehead out, that's the activity started here.
But Kevin Dyson will not probably be in your top 10. He only had about a 5 or 6 year career, but he is doing good work right now in Nashville. And in fact, one of the things that I enjoy about him is that he is very much he's active on Twitter, and he does pay attention when people mention him. So, hey, you know, I'm happy to hear about that. That's one of those things I like about people like that who recognize what fans like them.
Yeah, that definitely, you know, he was a great player. I mean, I don't think he got much of the credit that he should have when he was playing, because maybe it's because his career was so short, but he was effective when he did play. You know, there's plenty of players that only played a few years in the league for whatever reason throughout history, but the ones that were really effective, you remember, and Dyson's definitely a name I remember. And it's been 20 years since he's played.
Yeah. His problem was he played alongside a guy named Derek Mason. And Derek Mason was a five-star athlete or five-tool athlete before we really thought about somebody like, a Devin Hester, somebody like that. But Kevin Dyson, I just wanted to throw him out there. I'm going to represent the 615 here. And and I just want to throw him out there. But, yeah, when you look at people like that, but there's one guy, if I could bring him up right now, Darren, that I enjoy, and I love watching him play.
Sure.
Now, sadly, he passed away just a few years ago. Dwight Clark.
Yes.
Now,
definitely.
What I say about Dwight Clark is this. He was not the fastest guy, nor the most athletic guy. But the one thing that I enjoy watching about him is that if you threw it in his area, he didn't drop passes.
I mean, I think he really showed off that number 87 when he caught that pass in the NFC Championship game from Montana to sort of propel the 49ers into their dynasty.
Yeah, and if you don't know what that is, I believe it's called the catch.
Yes, it is.
And the one thing I love about this is – Joe Montana, if you were to watch that play, Joe Montana is falling backwards. And I believe he had Ed Tuchel Jones, and I can't remember the other one. But he had two Cowboys bearing down on him, and he falls backwards and tosses the ball. And the reason why he did that is he knew where Dwight Clark would be. It wasn't that he knew that Dwight Clark is – he had that much trust and faith in Dwight Clark to put the ball right where his hands would be. And he also knew how high Dwight Clark could jump. Now, he's kind of like me. You could put a credit card underneath my jump, and you can measure my jump from that. But for that moment, Joe Montana had that much trust in a guy named Dwight Clark, who was actually, I believe, drafted before – yeah, I think he was drafted before – Montana was. So he had the chance to see Dwight Clark play, but he had that much faith to know that at the last play to beat the Cowboys, that Dwight Clark is going to make that reception.
Yeah, that is one of those plays that's probably forever be in controversy, because you have one side that's saying, and even Montana says, no, I intentionally threw it to that position. And it sounds like just like what you're saying here. And you have those that are saying, you know, Montana was throwing the ball away and, you know, just didn't do it well enough. And Clark happened to be there and made a great grab. I mean, either way, I look at it, I don't care how it happened. It happened, and a guy caught the ball for a touchdown and put his team in a Super Bowl. And like I said, it sparked that franchise into a dynasty.
Now, if I remember correctly, Darren, I might be off on that. That was in 1981.
Yes.
That season, again, according to Pro Football Reference, he had 85 receptions for 1,105 yards. Those were unheard of at that time. That type of play, that type of catching and receiving yards were pretty much unheard of. And not only did Dwight Clark do it, but he also made sure that Joe Montana had – it takes a lot for a man or anybody to have that much faith in another person to throw the ball up and know that there's going to be a guy there to catch it. And that tells you who Dwight Clark was to Joe Montana.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, he wasn't the fastest guy. He was a big for a wide receiver, big for a wide receiver in this area, you know, 6'4", 212 during his playing days. But he wasn't a speedster, but he ran good, solid routes, and he was where he was supposed to be when he was supposed to be. And that's a great thing for a quarterback to know. You know, when you have somebody that's going to be there and be dependable, like you said, that's outstanding for a quarterback. And he really fit the mold, just like the rest of those pieces on the 49ers offense, that West Coast offense that Bill Walsh had. It was very dependent upon, you know, people doing their jobs. And Dwight Clark definitely did.
Absolutely.
I guess maybe another player that we'll talk about, and we got to talk about, you know, Willie Davis. And Willie Davis is our other Hall of Famer that we have on here. And he, just like Dave Casper wore the jersey for 11 seasons, Willie Davis wore 87 for 10 seasons. And Willie Davis, another guy, you know, it's five Pro Bowls in his career, five All Pros, two Super Bowl champions, Super Bowl one and two with the Green Bay Packers, and five NFL championships, all a decade team of the 1960s, you know, Hall of Famer. And, you know, 6'3", 243-pound defensive tackle. Now, he spent his first 2 years as a Cleveland Brown, and he wore number 77 during those 2 years, 1958 and 1959. And we just had John Turney on from the Pro Football Journal, and John is one of the gentlemen that recently him and Nick Webster, his cohort on Pro Football Journal, that got their stats, their research placed on the Pro Football Reference to recognize sacks between the 1960 season and the 1981 season.
Okay. I saw that, and I'm glad you clarified that, because it says here 99.5 sacks.
Yeah.
That's insane.
It certainly is. That's without the two seasons for Cleveland.
Yes.
As John Turney, when I just had him on the other night, he said, you know, that's what their project is right now. It's their white whale. They're trying to grab the same things, the same game books and any game films, you know, which are really sporadic for the 1950s in the NFL, to try to get sack totals for, and he doesn't know if he'll ever accomplish it in his lifetime or if anybody will, but he's trying to get those sack totals for the 1950s to add on with that great collection they gave us of the, you know, 20 some years that they did, you know, recently. And so he's probably well over 100, but we don't know what he did with those 2 years with Cleveland for sure.
Well, when you watch Willie Davis, I remember watching a lot of the NFL films of the Green Bay Packers. You can't, it's like with Dwight Clark in the early 80s and with Dave Casper, you can't really write the Lombardi dynasty without Willie Davis. You can't. He is up there with one of the best, you know, defensive players of that era. And the best part about Willie Davis is he had every type of skill that you can tell. Of course, I think I might have watched the Super Bowl one and two. Actually, it was Super Bowl one and two. It was World Championship, but very smooth player. You know, you don't have to be fast. You could be smooth and get to a place where you need to be, and you could be really deceptively fast. But he's very smooth, very strong, and very smart player. Well deserving of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and well deserving to be on this list, even though he did spend 2 years wearing number 77.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, just think about that. We have 99 and a half sacks for him only as a Packer. He was a Packer for 10 years. That's 10 sacks per season in an era where he only played 14 games in regular season. And actually, his first year in Green Bay, they only played 12 games. So that's not on the 17 games that we have in today's NFL, or the 16 that we just recently had. You know, that's 10 sacks a year. In an era they didn't pass very much.
No.
And they only had 14 games. That's unbelievable.
What I love about this also is that he, according to Pro Football Reference, he has 22 fumble recoveries. That's awesome.
Oh,
which tells you that he's a very heady player. You know, he's aware of where he is. because sometimes you'll see a ball pop out and people stand around. Well, when you get 22 fumble recoveries, you're not standing around. You're looking for the ball.
Yeah. That, I mean, that just tells you what an athlete he was. You know, he's like you say, he's around the ball, jumping on fumbles, getting sacks. I mean, stopping the run. And, you know, it doesn't sound like he's that big by today's standards, 6'3", 243 pounds. But that was a pretty big man back in that era. You know, that was your offensive linemen were only, you know, 230s, 250 at the most back in that era. And, you know, so he was definitely up to the task of his athleticism, his size, his strength, just a great player. Well, and Green Bay was very fortunate to get him when they did.
That's a little bigger than Derek Brooks. And I think Derek Brooks did all right as a linebacker.
Yeah. Yeah. He definitely did. Definitely did. And that's probably what he would be if Willie Davis played in the modern NFL. He'd probably be like an edge rusher or something. I'm sure. Cause that's the size.
I'd love to see, and they didn't keep up with us, but I would love to see his 40. I would think that he would have one of those 40s that you like. He is deceptively fast. He's not Tom Brady. He's fast. I would love to see that because watching him play, like I said, it was very smooth. He almost, you would like look at him and turn away and he'd be in another spot. He was like, how that happened? That's Willie Davis.
Yeah, that's a bunch of that's probably something like we said, you know, John Turney was telling me he's got a lot of those stats on Pro Football Journal. I don't have up right now to take a look, but he was even saying, you know, they didn't have the 40 yard dash your time and they were timing them in the 100. So, you know, anything, you know, sub 10, that was a pretty good time, especially for a lineman. So I'm sure he's probably in that 9-something range.
That's pretty good going 9 seconds to go 100 yards. That's better than James Harrison did in the Super Bowl. He rumbled, stumbled, bumbled all the way down to 99 yards like that.
Look at you with another Steelers reference.
I'm on fire today. I've been holding it in for several weeks now.
Those 47 Steelers, they got you all fired up.
They did. Go, you know, I have a link to that book on my Twitter page. Go and check that out. But Willie Davis, I would definitely put, if I had a team that I could put people on, Willie Davis would be on the short list.
Yeah, I agree. And I wanted to make sure you mention that. So I think we're going to both put Willie Davis on our list. I think Casper's our other one that's definitely on the list.
Casper has to be on the list. Yes.
Okay. All right. So that's, I just want to make sure that now Dwight Clark, and Dyson, we'll leave them as question marks right now. Cause we got a lot of players to talk about.
Let me put Kevin Dyson as a coin flip. He's going to flip the coin.
Okay. All right. Now who else would you like to talk about here? That's our Hall of Famers is Davis and Casper. And I said, I think we have maybe three players that are going to probably make the Hall of Fame here in our lifetime.
Well, the one that will make it, and I know you agree with me, even though it hurts me to say this, Reggie Wayne.
Yep, definitely. That's one I'm thinking of.
Now, it hurts me to say this. I respect this man's game. The fact that he did what he did with Marvin Harrison next to him tells you how good of a player Reggie Wayne was. But I have seen Reggie Wayne play in person, and he has killed my Titans so many times. It just hurts to say it, but I got to give a guy props.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that. That'd be a division rival for those years.
Yeah, I have it.
Yeah. Wow, just like, believe me, it was hurt me when you were talking about Dyson, because back when Dyson played, the Oilers and the Titans were in the AFC Central playing against the Steelers twice a year. Oh, so
yeah, I still don't know how the Indianapolis Colts are in the AFC South. I don't know how that works, you know, but well, that's what I get to thinking.
How is Dallas in the NFC East? You know, it's the money.
Yeah, it's money. It's what it is. But look at his stats. Reggie Wayne, 1,070 receptions. That's incredible. He had four seasons of over 100 receptions. Again, that's with Marvin Harrison next to him. That tells you that Peyton Manning's arm probably fell off a few times and they had to super glue it back on. And he had Edgerrin James too. I mean, come on. How unfair is that to have those guys and Dallas Clark? He's one of these 87s. If you've not seen Dallas Clark play, he was one of those guys that could get overlooked because you had Marvin Harrison and Reggie Wayne. Yeah. And I believe Edgerrin James is in the Hall of Fame. Am I right on that?
Yeah, I saw him get inducted about a month ago. He went in this year, the class of 2020.
See, so there you go. That shows you that team, we're talking about the 70 Steelers. If it wasn't for the Patriots, the Colts would have more than one Super Bowl.
Yeah.
They would have multiple Super Bowls because they had a team and their defense wasn't that shabby either.
No. Well, I think their defense had some good players on it, but I think it had some question marks as a defense as a whole. I think that might be part of the reason why they didn't have the success. I mean, definitely they had their money. All their chips were in that offensive side. You know, you had to surround Peyton Manning. You had to protect him. You had to give him some running backs. You know, you had Falk during his time there. You had, you know, Edgerrin James to replace Falk, you know, another Hall of Famer, Wayne and Marvin Harrison, Dallas Clark, like you said. But the defense, they had, you know, they had Feeney, got to mention,
what's his name? He was, mine went blank, but he was a defensive tackle or defensive end.
I know who you're talking about.
Him and Freeney, having them to combine, see, that made life miserable for Kerry Collins and for Vince Young and for Steve McNair. I remember those days.
Well, the other player, I got to mention it because he is from Erie, and I actually officiated his games when he was younger in high school, and that's Bob Sanders was their safety.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he was a hard-hitting guy, too, went to Iowa, but he's from Erie.
Name dropping right now. There you go. You only get this on the Pigskin Dispatch.
You mentioned another Erie guy earlier, Fred Biletnikoff, when you said that, too. He's from Erie also. Yeah, but Reggie Wayne, yeah, I mean, I didn't realize he had over 14,000 yards of receiving, and I didn't realize he had 82 touchdowns. You know, that's in his career. That's just remarkable.
Now, if you want to take this into consideration, Reggie Wayne, I want to say, looking, he is definitely in the top 10 on receiving yards. But again, if he was not with Marvin Harrison, who Marvin Harrison was all world. Can you imagine what his stats would look like right now?
Well, we actually had a conversation like this one with John Turney when we were talking about jersey number 85s. We were talking about Mark Clayton and Mark Duper. And I brought this point up to John. And I think it really goes for Reggie Wayne and Marvin Harrison. I mean, they balanced each other. You couldn't double cover. If you double covered one, the other one's going to be open. And you couldn't play straight man on them. And you had a guy slinging the ball around like Peyton Manning. So I think maybe if only one of them was on there and there was a couple, you know, C receivers on the other side, I don't know that they would have the numbers they have that we're seeing today. I think they both opened up coverage for each other, just like Mark Duper and Mark Clayton did with Dan Marino throwing a rock, Stallworth and Swan with Bradshaw throwing them. I think, these are from different eras, but I think you couldn't double cover one because you'd get burned by the other.
What I love about Pro Football Reference is it gives you the catch percentage.
Mm-hmm.
They targeted and catch it 68% in 2005. That means that for every 10 passes toward Reggie Wayne, he's going to catch 7. That's you don't see that. That is just – that's unreal.
Right.
and you know, you think, well, that doesn't – if I was a quarterback who needed a reception, I'm going to look for a guy that's going to catch it 70% of the time before I look for a guy that's going to catch it 50. And this is Peyton Manning, who had – four guys, if you count James, who could do that. It's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, you look at that. The other stat I like looking at, especially with somebody like Wayne, is their long touchdowns of the year. And his shortest, longest scoring catch was 33 yards. And that was in 2012. Now, that was his worst. you know, every other year is up. Well, you know, many of them are in the 60s. He's in the 70s once or twice, 80 at the end of his career. Now those are some big yardage, chunk yard plays that he's a part of. So
when's
that's
the last time you ran 80 yards with somebody chasing you.
I think I was probably chasing a food truck or something. The ice cream man was going down the street, maybe, and I didn't catch him. So, so yeah, I think Reggie Wayne's probably another one that's you know, a sure thing to put on this list as our third player.
Absolutely. I've got to throw out. I don't think he's going to be on this list, but he is one of my favorites simply because of what he did. Joe Horn.
Yeah, great player.
Joe Horn. Now, why is Joe Horn one of my favorites? Because he really tried to take up self, you know, self-celebration, you know, celebrating a touchdown. And I believe this was in the Superdome. He caught a touchdown pass, went underneath the – there's a foam around the uprights, picked it up. Underneath it, he had a flip phone, dialed the flip phone, and started talking – after he scored a touchdown. Now, what in the world is a flip phone? Most people say, what is a flip phone? A phone that you flip in order to call. Google it. It's on. It's the old school stuff.
Yeah, I think they're coming back.
Oh, my goodness.
They're back in vogue.
Okay. I'm ready for them to come back with the rotary dial. I want them to come back.
Yeah. Most kids don't know what a rotary dial is. That's
Golly, see, I remember the rotary dial. The last thing you wanted to dial was somebody with a zero because you had to listen to go all the way around.
Yeah, that's for sure. I had a number I had to call quite often. I forget what it was, but the number was like, you know, 0300, the last four digits. Yeah, what a pain in the neck that was. And you didn't have speed dial on a rotary phone. It was,
if you had messed to dial up, it. Too, you had to hang up and do it over again.
That's for sure.
That Joe Horn had a solid career. I believe he did, and he could be on the fringe of making this. But when I look at Joe Horn, I think of that that one play, and I remember him doing that. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, and I forget what he did, but I know there was something really a great act of kindness he did after Hurricane Katrina to the folks down in New Orleans, and I can't remember what it was, but it was something pretty out of the ordinary and spectacular that was memorable. Of course, now I don't remember it, but I do remember he was a part of something really nice for the community.
Well, if only we had the internet.
Yeah, that's for sure. But
according to whodatdish.com, it's actually pretty neat. It says that he went and actually donated money.
Okay.
He went and donated some things. He went to play touch ground. He said, I was on the golf course when I got a call from my coach. And he said, pack your clothes and get your family out of Dodge and tell them like this. There was nothing else to say. Organizations paid us as players, so we did what the organization told us. But, yeah, it was actually pretty neat that when he got back to the Superdome and got back around, he went around helping people.
Yeah, I remember that sort of changed, you know, because I always sort of looked at him like with the phone thing. He was almost like a, you know, Terrell Owens and Ocho Cinco were all in that same era. And you sit there and you say, okay, these diva wide receivers, they got to do something to, you know, celebrate and get themselves in trouble just to get attention. But then when Joe Horn did that after Katrina, it changed my perception of him and made me enjoy the player much more. Yeah. For being a good person.
See, I don't mind the flip phone as much as I mind what Terrell Owens did to that guy's popcorn. You know how much popcorn cost? And he dumped it all in his mouth and then threw it down and went and paid for the guy's popcorn. I mean, come on. All that Joe Horn had to do was worry about roaming.
Well, I was talking more like Terrell Owens with the Sharpie, and he was the one with the Sharpie, right?
He was the one with the Sharpie, and I don't know how you kept it in your sock that long.
Of course, how do you get a flip phone in the padding of the goalpost? I don't know that either.
Well, hey, it's one of those things that next time on the Pigskin Dispatch, we're going to do a little inside we're going to do some investigation. We're going to find out. Wonder if Arnie will send us down to New Orleans on the company dime and let us find out how that happened.
Some football forensics.
Oh, there's your new podcast. We'll find out how balls can be deflated, and we'll find out. We'll find out how fast a guy can actually run a 100-yard dash.
There you go. There you go. In full pads.
In full pads, absolutely.
So you're gonna be that test subject, and not me. So I'm the guy chasing. I'll chase the ice cream truck, but
you're gonna see a 42-year-old guy fall over after 10 yards. It's gonna happen.
All right. Well, yeah, Joe Horn. I think we'll put him under some consideration here at the end too. Maybe we can talk about him and get him on this list too. I said there was two defensive players, and we already talked about Willie Davis. Claude Humphrey is the other one I had in mind. And actually, Claude Humphrey is in the Hall of Fame. I missed him being in the Hall of Fame, and I apologize for that. You know, this man, a defensive end, he played for the Atlanta Falcons and for most of his career, 10 years, came in 1968 season. And then his last three years were with the Philadelphia Eagles. And what this guy had, you know, again, John Turney and Nick Webster have him down for 130 sacks in his career.
And good gracious.
And again, most of those seasons were 14 game seasons. And he had a couple years. He missed one complete year, 1975, with a knee injury. And he only played four games in 1978. So very productive. And the thing that really amazed me is in his second to last year, 1980, I mean, so he's a 12-year veteran at this point with the Eagles, 15 and a half sacks in a 16 game season. That's pretty good for, you know, at that point, an old timer, you know, on the defensive line.
I'm just looking at his awards. It takes up a whole page. Golly. Yeah. Now, see, the problem with Claude Humphrey, of course, I see he was born in Memphis, Tennessee, so represent the Tennessee there. And he went to Tennessee State, where my dad and my sister graduated college from. So there you go. And where Eddie George is now the coach. How about that?
That's right.
First round, third overall pick, 1968. The problem with Claude Humphrey is he played for the Atlanta Falcons. Now, you think, well, the Atlanta Falcons are a pretty solid team now. In the 60s and the 70s, they weren't. They weren't. The Falcons came into their own, in my opinion at least, when they drafted Deion Sanders and they started doing the primetime thing. Claude Humphreys, I believe he was on the – what do they call that? The Grits defense?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they did call it. The Falcons of the mid 70s weren't too bad though. They had, you know, Steve Barkowski, and you know, they were a pretty decent team. They didn't make it far into the playoffs, but I know they had some playoff runs during those things. Let's take a look at. Of course, they don't have any playoff games listed for Claude Humphrey, so maybe they didn't.
Well,
they did. Yeah, I'm sorry. Here it is.
No, that's fine. The only problem with that is if you think about the 70s, the Falcons were not the team that they are now. They really didn't. They didn't put it together until the early 90s. And I'm looking at this. Some of the players that they had were not. They just don't jump off the page at you. And if I remember correctly, when did the Falcons start? Was it 1968?
I believe it was. Yeah, because they were a battleground. Atlanta was between the AFL and the NFL. Might have been before. Might have been 66.
Norm Van Brocklin was their coach in 68. And I remember hearing about Norm Van Brocklin's coaching. He was a much better quarterback than he was a coach.
Yeah, and I stand corrected because I'm looking at Claude Humphrey's playoff record. Six games in the playoffs he played, and they were all with Philadelphia. So Atlanta did not make the playoffs in the 70s, like I was thinking. For some reason, boy, I remember Steve Barkowski, and I remember, you know, Humphrey playing for them. And I remember, you know, they had the red helmets with the black falcon on it.
Go back to those. I want them to come back, and I want the old school Seahawks to come back.
I like the red helmets. Those were sharp.
Oh, they were
much better than the black ones.
Even go back, if you're going to go back and do the primetime stuff again, please. And make sure MC Hammer is on the sideline.
I think the black helmets must have come in like when June Jones was their coach. I think he was trying to change the whole perception of the franchise. And I think that's when they went to all black, is when June Jones was there.
Now, look at the – I'm trying to pull up the 2014 Hall of Fame class and see where Claude Humphreys came in. And I can't really find it. I'm telling you what, if you make it to Walter Jones, okay, Walter Jones, I got the chance to meet Walter Jones in Aliceville, Alabama. If you come into the same class that probably the best, well, one of the top five offensive linemen of all time, you're doing something right. You're doing something right. So my hats off to Claude Humphreys there.
Yeah, and I can't believe I missed him being as a Hall of Famer too. I'm usually all over that. So
all right, Andre Reed, which was one of the best wide receivers of the 80s and 90s for the Bills. And I'll put one more in there, and I'll Michael Strahan, which I don't think the Giants would have won that Super Bowl without Strahan.
The NFL sack leader, I believe, correct? Is this Strahan? Or is that Bruce Smith ahead of him?
I think Smith is ahead of him, but I'm not certain. I want to say that Strahan might have the single season record.
But I remember there was a big thing when Favre sort of gave himself up to Strahan. I was thinking that was for the record.
Yeah, that was for the – yeah, I remember that.
For the single season record, you think that was?
That was for the single season. Okay, Strahan has 141 sacks, and I believe
Bruce Smith is 200.
I don't think anybody – the only one that I think could break it is if my mind went blank. J.J. Watt actually stayed healthy. I think he could have done it.
Yeah, I think Al Bubba Baker, I know with these unofficial stats that the attorney has, I know he's right in there with him. He's like in the 190s. He's real close.
Now, how, Darren, educate me. How is that going to work? Is this considered unofficial?
Yeah, they're unofficial, and John says he's fine with that. He just wanted the pleasure of being able to honor these players in an era that didn't have the stat. And he says he doesn't ever expect to see it become an official stat by the NFL. And it was his labor of love to get this done. And him and Nick Webster, they teamed up, and, you know, they were at the Pro Football Hall of Fame. They were at, organizations, headquarters, and getting every game book and film that they could get their hands on of NFL films. Chris Willis helped them out a lot. Chris does a lot of contributions to the Pro Football Journal too. And they just really all dug their heels in, and just this tremendous task that we get to enjoy sitting here talking about these guys.
I respect that. Keep up the good work, fellas.
Yeah, that most definitely. Okay. So we have, talked about some good players here. Those now are three Hall of Famers. I'm going to say we've got to put Claude Humphrey in there too. It's our four.
Okay, so far I have Dave Casper, Willie Davis, Reggie Wayne. Did you agree with that?
Reggie Wayne. That's our four that I have on there so far.
And Claude Humphrey. Now I have one that I'd like to suggest.
Okay.
Keenan McCardell.
Oh yeah, great player.
11,373 yards and 63 touchdowns. I remember him playing for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the San Diego Chargers, and a little bit for the Washington Redskins. But most of the things I remember was when he played for Jacksonville with Mark Grinnell. That team from 96 to 2001 were just amazing. And in fact, Jacksonville probably should have made it to the Super Bowl a couple of those years. That's the team in 96 that I remember beating my Broncos on the team that I thought could just dominate the Super Bowl. And they should have. The Broncos should have won three in a row. Jacksonville came into Denver and beat the tar out of them. He did that for a span of 5 or 6 years, just playing at a high level. Keenan McCardell was just an amazing player.
Yeah, he most definitely was. Now, I had to be tortured with this guy because, McCardell played 4 years with the Browns in the Steelers division. And then when Jacksonville came in the league, they were in the AFC Central, and he tortured us there for another 5 or 6 years that they were in the same division. Yeah, the guy just was a pain in the hind end, and he was like that clutch guy for whatever team he played for. It seemed like he was always making those big catches that they needed on like a 3rd and 12 or whatever. He was that go-to guy for all the quarterbacks he played with.
And what gets me, I'm looking at his stats here. You don't play from 1992 to 2007 without being in insane conditioning. That's amazing.
That is definitely true. Definitely true. He had two Pro Bowls and that Super Bowl championship while he was in the league, and the Super Bowl championship had to be the Buccaneers. I'm thinking probably 2003.
I would say that the Buccaneers would be the one that he won the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that would be it.
Because San Diego and Washington had won one since Joe Gibbs' time. And Cleveland, poor Cleveland. I can't say anything. but no, Keenan McCardell should be on that short list of potential. Him and Joe Horn off to the side. But I think he is one of those players that watching him play, you could just tell how good he was. He was just that good.
I agree. Let's put him, we'll mark him down and we'll come back to him, both those guys, Horn and McCardell. I think there's two other like slam dunks on this. And these are probably, in addition to Reggie Wayne, I think these are the other two contemporary players that I think have a good shot at the Hall of Fame. We already alluded to one. We talked about Gronkowski quite a bit. I think he's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer when he decides to hang it up. And I think Travis Kelce is on the trajectory to be that same kind of tight end.
I was looking at him on this list. There's a Reddit subpost that has the top 87 players to wear 87. And I saw him, and I did not realize Travis Kelce was number 87. Without Travis Kelce, is Kansas City as good as they are right now? They're going to be good, but he makes them that much better.
He is like their version of the possession receiver. They have the speedsters there, but he is their, and he's a tight end, but he's their possession guy. And Mahomes, I mean, really counts on him. Who was the quarterback that was there before Mahomes?
There was a quarterback before Mahomes?
Yeah, played for Washington.
Alex Smith.
Yeah, he was a go-to guy for Alex Smith as well. You know, the guy has 6 Pro Bowls under his belt so far, 3 All Pros, Super Bowl championship, lost another Super Bowl just recently, all decade team of the 2010s. And he's still, he's only been in the league since 2013.
It's almost unfair about how some GMs can do that. And then some GMs, pick Jamarcus Russell first overall.
Think about this. He has only had 2 seasons of his NFL career where he wasn't in the Pro Bowl. That's unfathomable, to me. And he's still going strong.
If Mahomes plays like he is right now, there's no reason for Kelce to even think about, take pay cuts, take the hometown discount. You're going to win some Super Bowls. We can win more. The one guy that I would like to bring up, he won't be on this list, but Ed McCaffrey.
Right. Yeah, he had a great player.
Ed McCaffrey is one of my favorite players of all time. He started with the Giants, but he went – now, most people know him as the father of Christian McCaffrey. But Ed McCaffrey, there is one play, and I think it might have been in the Super Bowl against the Packers. He laid out a guy. Him and Hines Ward were probably the two dirtiest – hardest hitting wide receivers of all time. He laid out a guy on a block, and you'll see him point down to the guy and basically say, "You stay there." Ed McCaffrey was the original Wes Welker. He was the guy that would go over the middle and get just nailed. He was small. But John Elway, he was kind of like Dwight Clark. John Elway knew where he would be because he was such a good route runner. He had such good hands. He was dependable. And the best thing about receivers like Ed McCaffrey or, even now, there are some receivers like this, they didn't really say anything. They let the plates show how good they really were. It wasn't until, like, Chad Johnson – that you started seeing receivers try to make a big fuss. Lynn Swann wouldn't do it. John Stallworth wouldn't do it. Ed McCaffrey wouldn't do it. But Ed McCaffrey was part of the reason why I think that the Broncos put it together in a 3-year span. He was one of those reasons.
Yeah. Well, I think I'd like to maybe mention, though, he wasn't really a small receiver. He was a pretty big guy. He was 6'5", 215 pounds.
Okay, I was thinking of something different then, but his size.
You know, when you start comparing Walker, I'm thinking, man, I'm always picturing this long, lanky guy going down there and, you know, having those.
No, you're right about the height. I apologize for that. For going over the middle, 215 pounds is not big.
No, but he was tough as nails. That's
oh, absolutely, he was.
And the precise routes that he ran, especially when you have, you know, somebody like Elway firing a ball to you, and that what they call it, the Elway tattoo or whatever.
The Elway Y.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, if you haven't heard that, Elway threw the ball so hard that if you caught it on the tip of the ball, it would leave an indention in your hand, and they called it the Elway Y because it looked like a Y.
Yeah, and I think, as a matter of fact, they had one of the episodes of Peyton's Places. You know, he was the guest on Peyton Manning's program, and Peyton Manning asked him, you know, even at the advanced age at Elway's at the throw one and give him the Y on his hands, and he did it to Peyton Manning too. And he's probably, God, he's got to be 60 years old, I would think, by now.
He had to put some Bengay on his arm after that. It happens, right, guys. It happens when you get older. Things hurt. You're laughing, but that's for another day. But if it wasn't for McCaffrey, Rod Smith, Shannon Sharp, Terrell Davis, one of my all-time favorite players ever, John Elway wouldn't have his two Super Bowls, but Elway put it together those last 2 years, and McCaffrey was part of the reason why he did it.
I totally agree. Now, I guess a couple other receivers. I've got probably three more that I know we definitely got to mention. One of them is Mushin Muhammad. Spectacular guy, this guy. When you talk about a receiver you can count on to catch a ball, this guy is one of them.
Love watching him with the Bears. Oh, gosh. When Cutler went to the Bears, I think they might have had a year where they played together. Just even watching him before that. There goes the dog. Muhammad was such a good player that you didn't have to worry about him dropping anything.
Yeah, I think he really put Jake Delhom at Carolina on the map, too, at the Super Bowl run they had in the – I believe when Carolina went to the Super Bowl the first time with Dell Holmes at quarterback. And, you know, Mushin Muhammad was definitely the guy that Dell Holmes always looked forward to when they had the long yardage or had to get that, third and four. He was that possession receiver and just a big body, 6'2", 215, but just a great hands and a great catch radius. I'm not sure what the length of the man's arms are, but they have to be exceptional. 860 receptions in his career, 11,438 yards, 62 touchdowns, two Pro Bowls and one All Pro for the man they called Moose.
Mushin now, there is a trivia question that you can stump your friends with. Who was the quarterback that took the Panthers to the Super Bowl in early 2000s?
Right.
Not too many people remember Jake Delhom.
Right. Yeah, that's he had kind of a crazy career. You know, he was up and down. He was like a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. You didn't know what quarterback you're going to get because he had that great season taking them to the Super Bowl. And then what, he had one season where he had like sort of like three or four interceptions a game.
It's
a fine line.
It was bad. Yeah, it was bad. But he nearly won too. You really look at that Super Bowl and think that the Panthers should have won that Super Bowl. But the Patriots did what Patriots did.
That's for sure. Another receiver I wanted to talk about that I think is worth mentioning here is Ricky Prohl. Part of that greatest show on turf of the Rams teams for when they were St. Louis. He played for multiple teams. He played start off with Phoenix, when Phoenix turned into Arizona, he was with them, Seattle for a couple of years, Chicago, St. Louis, Carolina, Indianapolis, the end of his career. But this guy had, you know, just under 9,000 yards of receiving, 54 touchdowns, won two Super Bowls. So nothing to forget there, you know, good receiver there too.
a couple more. Eric Decker, I watched him play with the Titans. He was very, very good player. Married to Jesse James, so guys, he did all right. Eric Decker was one of those receivers that you could count on. He didn't have a long career, but he was pretty good. Ben Coates. Ben Coates, one of my favorite tight ends as well. Very, very good tight end during the time that the Patriots were becoming the Patriots. I believe he went to a Super Bowl in 96. Yeah, he went to Super Bowl 96 with Drew Bledsoe as the quarterback. So, you know, he did all right too.
Yeah. Another one we got to make sure we mention, Jordy Nelson. I mean, because what a brilliant career he had. You know, he wore that jersey for 10 seasons. And, you know, Jordy, you know, we remember him as a Packer. I think he spent his final year as a Raider. Yeah, he did in 2018. But we remember that was an Aaron Rodgers guy, you know. But I was surprised he only had one Pro Bowl and one, you know, had the one Super Bowl championship. I forget who they beat, so we don't want to talk about it. But that had that Pro Bowl, and it was 2016's AP Comeback Player of the Year. You know, if that nasty injury he had that season before.
Oh, gosh, I remember that. Yeah. Oh, Jordy Nelson is one of those guys that I don't think of him as a Raider. You don't think of Joe Montana as a – or Joe Montana as a Chief or Joe Namath as a Ram. I don't think of Jordy Nelson as a Raider. I
think in all the moves that the Packers organization has upset their fans over, you know, and I'm talking, you know, Brett Favre and you know, things like that. I think when they had to decide to let Jordy Nelson cut loose with him and go with those younger receivers they had, and he went with Oakland. I don't even think he didn't want to be there. None of the Packers fans want him to be there. You know, Aaron Rodgers didn't want him to be in Oakland. But it's unfortunate. You don't want to remember those days when they're the team they didn't want to be with. You know, you want to remember him as a Packer because that's what he was.
3 years he had over 10 touchdowns, and that is, and looking at his yards per reception, 18.6 in 2011, which tells you that there was. I wish they had the separation between the receiver and the cornerback, because Jordy Nelson was quick. He wasn't the fastest, but he had a way to dart in and get open. He was a great route runner, was able to get in under the coverage, especially if you played zone against him. Jordy Nelson was one of those guys that could find an opening in the zone. He knew where the holes were, the weak parts were. So if you're looking at 18.6, that's – you know, that's a first down, a pop. You want to know why Aaron Rodgers didn't want him to leave. If you give up 18.6 yards of reception, that's pretty harsh.
Yeah. I mean, he averaged, 10 years, 72 touchdowns. That's over 10 touchdowns a season. And his first three seasons, he only had a total of 6 for his first three seasons. And in Oakland, he only had 3 touchdowns. So it's those years in between, you know, when you're leading the league with 14 touchdowns in 2016 and you're a comeback player of the year, 13 the year before that, 15 touchdown receptions in 2011. You know, that definitely draws some attention to you. And he had another real nice player, Jordy Nelson, at the wide receiver position.
Let me put you on the spot here. Okay. Jordy Nelson's not a Hall of Famer. I get that. You get that. He is a really good Hall of Famer, but not a Pro Football Hall of Famer. Do you believe that you have to take a man's entire career into consideration, or do you take, say, 4 or 5 years of his height into consideration when looking at somebody for the Hall of Fame?
You know what? I don't know what puts you in the Hall of Fame. I don't know, you know. I mean, some people say you got to be a good player and you have to have the Super Bowl rings. And I think that's true in some cases. But there's great players that don't have Super Bowl rings that are in there. Just ask anybody from the 1970s Vikings teams in the Hall of Fame or the 90s Bills teams. You know, no Super Bowls, but there are Dan Marino. But I don't know that they have a set criteria to get people in. because I think there's probably a lot of players that are not in the Hall of Fame. I can think of probably five or six right now that are probably better players than some that are in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion.
Put Ken Riley in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I agree. He's one of the ones I'm talking about.
Jim Marshall needs to be in the Hall of Fame.
Al Bubba Baker, LC yes. Greenwood.
Yes.
I think these are the guys that deserve to be in. And I think LC Greenwood, you know, it's hard for me to say this, and people, I'll probably get the hate mail after five Steelers going in the Hall of Fame this past summer. But LC Greenwood, I think, is slighted because he has so many other of his teammates that are in the Hall of Fame. I mean, there's a lot of Hall of Famers that were on that defensive team with him. And then you go to the offensive side, there's a lot of Steelers from the 70s in the Hall of Fame. I think that's sort of against him. I think Ken Riley slighted because the team he played on was not a very good team. I think that's, he wasn't, you know, they weren't on television every week. And the sports writers, who I believe are the main voters for the Hall of Fame, they didn't get to see him every week. You know, Al Bubba Baker played an era where they didn't celebrate the accomplishments by statistics of a defensive lineman. I think that's some reasons why these guys aren't in, but it's time to get some of these players that played longer than 30 or 40 years ago, just like they did for the 2020 class. They only did it because of Centennial, but they need to make a move and get some of these players on there while, you know, we've lost some of them and they'll never see themselves getting the gold jacket on, but there's still some of them.
Yeah. Ken Riley died last year.
Right. I think LC Greenwood passed also. He's another one, you know, we just got to get these guys in there while they can enjoy it, and they can, their families and their fans can see them put that jacket on and get, you know, the bronze bust. And
you look at these guys, Dave Kasper is in the Hall of Fame. Was he the best tight end at that time? He was top five, easy. But with the Raiders, how they played, they were on TV a lot. You're right about that. Willie Davis, the Packers were football in the 60s. They were. And you look at Claude Humphrey. Claude Humphrey came about in a time where football started to pick up steam, especially in the South, because college football, if you go below Kentucky, it's college football. This is not a pro football area. It's college football. Claude Humphrey came into a college football built era. I mean, you're looking at Georgia, University of Georgia. If you go into Georgia right now, I know from my family down there, they're not Falcons fans. They're Bulldogs fans, and they like the Falcons. But Claude Humphrey came into a situation where he was playing on a team that weren't getting the attention. They were new, but it's a Bulldogs world. And then even in Atlanta, they shared the limelight with a Georgia Tech team that actually, I believe, in the 60s was pretty good, or could have been. I'm not certain about that. In the 70s, I believe they were too as well. So there's a lot of things that if you look at, a lot of these men are getting slighted because, well, the time that they were playing, TV, growing up in the 80s, Darren, you know this as well. You had a game at 12 o'clock, a game at 3 o'clock, and Monday Night Football. And you didn't get to choose. You didn't have Sunday Ticket. You had to watch what they were going to watch. And what were people watching in that 70s and 80s? You saw the Cowboys play. You saw the Raiders play. You might have seen the Jets play. But you didn't see the Falcons play very much. You didn't see the Bengals play very much. You certainly didn't see the Buccaneers play because they were just playing bad. So a lot of these guys that should get the attention are not getting what they deserve.
Yeah, I mean, case in point, Super Bowl 13, the Steelers against the Cowboys, 1978, I think it was played. So it was a 77 season. Between the two sidelines and players on the field, 25 of those people are in the Hall of Fame. Now, that's including coaches, you know, personnel, directors, you know, and the players. But 25 guys of two teams that were on television every Sunday on a national audience. And if you go look at that, I can't even think of another Super Bowl. Let's say like that Carolina team with Dell Holm. How many of those players are in the Hall of Fame? They didn't really have a national audience all the time, even though they were a very good team. And maybe they'll get one or two players that'll be in the Hall of Fame.
Julius Peppers deserves to be in the Hall of Fame if he is not there. He deserves to be in
there. Right. But, you know, they're not going to have players, maybe Muhammad, you know, who knows. But there, that's what I'm saying. And I think that has something to do with it. And it's unfortunate. But I think that's part of it. And it's just human nature, because that's who we watched. And the sports writers are people just like us. That's who they watch. And especially back in the 70s, before, you know, NFL ticket and, you know, the internet, you didn't know some of these players, especially West Coast. I mean, I only knew the Raiders. I really didn't know the other teams and players on the other teams on the West Coast, because we didn't really get to watch them that often in my market. You know, we had the East Coast.
We didn't get anybody down here because we didn't have any. I think I might have seen the Falcons play a lot because it was considered a local market in Dixon. But wherever Pat Summerall and John Madden were, that's what we watched. And I'm glad, because I believe that we were spoiled back in the 80s listening to those guys go. They were awesome.
Right. All right. Well, we got to get, I guess we got to get down to business here. We got to, I can't think of any other players to mention unless you have any that we haven't talked about.
I think we have five. We got five that are shoe-ins.
Well, okay. Maybe I'm missing the fifth then. I have our four that we talked about a little bit. We have Willie Davis.
Did you put Gronk in?
Oh yeah. Gronk. Okay. Yeah, definitely. Okay. We'll put Gronk on. So there's our five. So we have with Gronk, we have Willie Davis, Dave Casper, Claude Humphrey, and Reggie Wayne.
Right.
Now, some of the other ones that we talked and we said under consideration.
Travis Kelce is, if you ask me, I would put him in.
I would too. I agree with you. So let's put him on a six.
Let's put him in. Now, again, I want Kevin Dyson flipping the coin. He is there in my heart. Kevin, you're there. Okay. But then you have Joe Horn and Keenan McCardell. And what do you think about those two fellas?
Well, I'm sort of on the fence about Horn. I think Keenan McCardell, I think, definitely should be on there.
Well, I agree with you on Keenan. Joe, I just love his flip phone. That's all. That's the big thing.
We'll come back to Horn here. But I think McCardell, I think Muhammad should be. I mean, that's one that I would – say, I mean, with his statistics that he had,
I agree.
So that takes us to eight if we put him on. Okay, now we get into what I'm thinking is probably a bunch of guys that are sort of in the same boat. And I think, you know, Dyson's in there. I think Horn, like you said, Dwight Clark, interesting.
Do you take Dwight Clark for that one play and say that the history you made makes you one of the top 87? The more 87.
I would probably also say, you know, McCaffrey, Jordy Nelson, Ricky Prohl.
Yeah.
I think they're all in that sort of that bunched up in there in my mind. And I can't think of who, if I was going to take two of them, I don't know which two I would take. I mean, I guess I sort of lean towards Dwight Clark because what he accomplished in the team game, but that's what I just said. That's how guys are getting into Hall of Fame, by being, you know, noticed because they're on TV every week. But
Dwight Clark was Jerry Rice before Jerry Rice. He was Joe Montana's top receiver at that point. And I'm trying to think of anybody who was the second or third receiver on that list, and I can't think of anybody.
Probably Roger Craig. Yeah,
Roger Craig. Good gracious! Of course, that'd be a good one to have as a backup.
Yeah, was John Taylor there before Rice? Was John Taylor older than they? I know they were contemporaries, but he might have been there a couple years.
They would have been about the same time. I'm not certain, but every time I think of John Taylor, I think of that reception over the middle against the Bengals.
Right.
Everybody was doubling Jerry Rice, and then get it to him. Dwight Clark, if you're going to put him on the same level as Gronk, I don't think he's there. I think he had that plane, a good career, but I don't know if he's one of the top to wear 87.
Okay.
I don't know. But I can be changed. My boat can change pretty easily.
Well, okay, you like Horn. So let's go ahead. Let's give Horn our ninth spot.
All right. And I'll give Clark the 10th. You gave me Horn, I'll give you Clark.
Okay. Here's where I'm torn though. I like, as much as I like Clark, I like Ricky Prohl. Oh. And I also like McCaffrey. You know, I think they're all different players.
But see, if you're going to go with pure stats, I believe Clark is a better player than McCaffrey was.
Okay. I think you sold me then. All right, let's go with McCaffrey as our 10th then. So I'll just run them down real quick here. Willie Davis, Dave Casper, Reggie Wayne, Claude Humphrey, Musha Muhammad, Keenan McCardle, Rob Gronkowski, Travis Kelce, Joe Horn, and Dwight Clark, as I have as our 10.
You know what? I think that's a pretty good 10 right there.
I agree. That was a lot of hard work. That was some good players.
That was fun.
Definitely. And there's guys from a lot of different eras over the last 50 years. So that's good when you can do that.
And I learned that I'm going to have to look at Claude Humphrey a lot closer. That is that's one thing I've enjoyed about your numbers, your best player by numbers, is that you bring up people that I have heard of but never watched or never did a lot of research on, mainly because a lot of the guys that you've talked about are like a Claude Humphrey that was on a subpar team but played great. You know, there's players on the Buccaneers in the 70s that were really good. Salmon, I believe it was his name, one of them. Who knows about him because they were on the Buccaneers. The Falcons, the same thing. Claude Humphrey, I'm going to have to watch some of his play.
Well, yeah, I think you definitely have to, because he was a good player. And I mean, even his last 3 years with the Eagles, he was substantial. And I'm glad he was in the Hall of Fame. You know why I don't have him under? The Pro Football Hall of Fame doesn't recognize him as a number 87. And he wore the number for 14 years. That's weird. Somebody made a clerical error.
Can you go in there and edit that and say, "Hey, do you know who I am?" You need to change that.
I'll be making a phone call in the morning. We'll get this straightened out here.
You got the president online, don't you?
They'll ban me from the state of Ohio as soon as I make those phone calls. But Jeremy, thank you very much for doing that. Now I have, I'm hoping we can, we have you jotted down for the number 90s. I don't know if you remember signing up for that.
Yes.
And I think I'm hoping I can twist your arm to come on one of our other series talking about these great games and hobbies that are affiliated with football. And
I have a close relationship with the Tecmo Bowl game. I have a very fond relationship with Tecmo Bowl. And I believe that's what we're going to talk about.
Yes, it is.
Next week. It's one of those games that I still have the codes from when I played it on the original Nintendo Entertainment Center system, and they still work. And that's one of the, they didn't have a save system in it. They had codes, but that's a little teaser. That's what we call a teaser.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you about it, and I can't wait to learn about Tecmo Bowl, because I'm going into this not knowing a whole lot about it, just like a lot of these other games and hobbies, and I'm getting educated by our experts. So I'm excited to hear about it. So look for that forward in the next couple of weeks here. We'll be talking on both those things with Jeremy. You can also make sure you check him out on Sports History Network. Football is Family. You can check the show notes out of this episode, and you can take you right over to the Football is Family on Sports History Network and your favorite podcast provider. Make sure you listen to Jeremy. You're on weekly or every other week?
Well, Jeremy? I'm trying the weekly with the flood and with life. There won't be one on this week. Life is just getting in the way. But We're going to get back on the habit of weekly. And I'm trying to talk my wife into doing the introduction for it. So you'll hear her great voice introducing the Football's Family podcast.
Well, another great reason to listen to it.
Yeah. Yeah. If you think, if you can't handle my voice, you can handle hers and just tolerate mine. But Darren, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, the pleasure is all mine and the appreciation is all mine. I couldn't do it without you, my friend. So we'll talk to you real soon. And thank you very much.
No problem.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.